everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a continuation of our special series, The Pain, the Profit, and the Politics of AIDS. We're going to examine the scientific debate. With us from Berkeley, California, is Professor Peter Duesberg. Dr. Duesberg is a professor of molecular and cellular biology at the University of California, Berkeley. He was the first to isolate a cancer gene through his work with retroviruses back in 1970. He mapped the genetic structure of this class of viruses. His work in retrovirus research awarded him an election to the National Academy of Sciences and an outstanding investigator grant from the National Institutes of Health. Based upon his knowledge of retroviruses, he has been at the forefront in challenging the single virus AIDS hypothesis and is published in the world's leading medical journals. As a consequence, Dr. Duesberg's hypothesis has won support from many scientists who have been outcast from the publishing their views, including Nobel laureates such as Kerry Mullis, the inventor of the PCR technology used in AIDS research. Nice to have you with us today.
Good morning, Gary. Well, likewise, I'm glad to be back on the front here with you.
What we're going to do today is we're going to look first at your own scientific background, as you are one of the very first scientists in the United States or in the world who actually challenged that a single weak retrovirus could cause 30-plus different conditions that could be dosed so devastating to the human immune system. And yet, when looking at the immune system, it was very difficult to find this actual virus. And you were the one who postulated that instead of looking at just the virus by itself, we should be looking possibly at the lifestyle or other co-indicating factors that could cause a person to manifest AIDS-defining illnesses. When I was at visiting your laboratory over 25 years ago at Berkeley, I spoke with the two senior professors, including the dean of your department, and they both made an interesting statement. They both told me that, quote, Peter is the brightest scientist here. Unfortunately, his work will never be accepted. And I said, why? And one of them looked up at the ceiling, then looked down, then shrugged his shoulders and says, it is about believing in a paradigm and not having the courage to challenge it. Peter has the courage to challenge it. His peers do not. He will be right and wrong. He'll be right about his hypothesis. He'll be wrong assuming that anyone except a handful of people like himself will have the courage to change it. Now, that's what they told me. And I found that remarkable because it was one of the first times in my career as a journalist and a scientist that I had someone had the courage within the establishment to go on the record, because I filmed him, saying this. And then we went to your laboratory and you held up this very thick book and you said, Gary, in this book is everything we know about retroviruses. And there's not one single retrovirus in here that does what this HIV virus is supposed to do. And then you went on to talk about what you thought were the real underlying causes of AIDS, defining illnesses. So what we want to do today is you now have 30 years of experience. You and hundreds of thousands of scientists, having spent hundreds of billions of dollars, having over 350,000 published papers, at one time having over 75,000 nonprofit and foundations raising money in the war on AIDS, and yet your work by the vast majority of scientists has been both ridiculed, mocked, derided. You have been personally attacked. Your funds have dried up. It's difficult for you to get published in some of the leading publications you once had no problem publishing in. So before we get into what you believe are the most important things to understand about what went wrong in the war on AIDS, and that's what I want you to talk about from a scientific point of view, tell us a little bit about your scientific background. I gave a very brief overview of what qualifies you to be able to talk about retroviruses.
I was recruited, so to speak, to the war on cancer, and specifically the virus cancer program. The leading theory at the time in the 60s, 70s, was that viruses might cause cancer. There were some animal models, like the famous Rous sarcoma virus, or the SV40 DNA tumor virus, the monkey virus, that these viruses could cause cancer in cell culture, in selected and in immune-deficient animals, for example. But that was the hope that we would now find viruses causing cancer, make a vaccine, and thus cancer would be controlled at last. So the choice of viruses, of course, was on viruses that wouldn't kill cells. Because if you want to create a cancer or generate a cancer, you can't start killing cells. That would be the opposite. That would be cancer cure, if you like, in essence. Yeah. So we focused on viruses that were not very cytotoxic, meaning killing cells. And the retroviruses, the RNA tumor viruses like HIV, were the first choice. They were the least cytotoxic. They were not cytotoxic at all. Nobody had ever proven or shown that retroviruses would kill cells. But we couldn't find these viruses. Well, not so surprisingly, these tumor viruses, because cancers simply are not contagious. But we were so locked into these viruses, this virus cancer program, we would have done anything to show it anyway. But still, cancer is not contagious. And so is AIDS. AIDS is not contagious either. I mean, why wouldn't heterosexuals get AIDS? That was what the AIDS establishment, the virus AIDS establishment predicted. It's a sexually transmitted virus. Well, we have it for 30 years. Where are the heterosexuals with AIDS in America, in Europe, for that matter, anywhere on that planet? Nowhere. It's only very small risk groups, minorities. In America, roughly 30,000 per 300 million. That's 1 in 10,000. Who get AIDS? Are you not telling me that only 1 in 10,000 in America would have had sex? We have 4 to 5 million babies in this country. Obviously, if it were a sexually transmitted disease, it would have happened exactly what the National Academy and the leading researchers predicted in confronting AIDS, except me, of course, I was not on that committee, that it would spread in the general population, and everybody was at risk. Now, 30 years later, that proved to be completely flawed, that prediction. It's only male homosexuals and intravenous drug users, and that's about it, a few handful of cases. 30,000 in 300 million, 1 in 10,000 Americans gets AIDS. And the same is in Europe, and the same in Africa, and everywhere else. So it was apparent that AIDS was not even a viral epidemic. Yet the money was flowing so heavily in this direction that all of my peers, and even me at the beginning, I wrote a big grant application, the last one that got funded, that the retroviruses couldn't possibly cause AIDS. We would have to look for some other explanations or some new things retroviruses could do that we haven't known. But we haven't found that in 30 years. What I've found instead, and what others have found, is that AIDS is completely associated or linked to so-called risk behavior. And risk behavior means recreational drugs, which were becoming popular in the 60s and 70s after Vietnam, in intravenous drug users, exclusively, of course, there, and in male homosexuals, in at least some so-called risk groups, the minority of male homosexuals who had hundreds and thousands of partners. And worst of all, soon after, in the 80s, late 80s, 87, 89, they thought we could inhibit HIV, like with chemotherapy, with drugs that would inhibit DNA synthesis, because retroviruses would make DNA. They were designed for this purpose only by Hurwitz in the 60s as a chemotherapy, kill DNA synthesis, the central molecule of life, to cure cancer. Well, it does treat cancer, it does kill cancer, with the unfortunate cost that it also kills a lot of normal cells. Well, they thought, wouldn't that be nice to treat AIDS patients that way, and the virus would be treated too? Yes, it is. But we are treating these things with these people for having a virus that doesn't do anything. We can't even find the AIDS virus ever. Not even Gallo and all of these leading researchers. All they found is antibody against the virus. The so-called AIDS test is antibody against the virus. And where there is antibody, there is no virus. That's why Dr. Gallo had these enormous problems finding the virus. And the same researchers in the United Kingdom, same problems. They all had to get it somehow from Montagnier in France. So there is no virus, and we treat people with DNA chain terminators. That is AIDS by prescription. We kill their immune system. We kill their guts. We affect their brain. They become feeble-minded, demented, and we induce, in fact, cancers that way. Chemotherapy has one other negative point, that is over long times, it also is carcinogenic in itself because it ruins the DNA synthesis. If the cell doesn't die, it's likely it's going to be mutated and changed, and that in consequence, increases the risk for cancer. So we are at a horrible stage, and we have not been able to change it. We have found no vaccine. Well, why not? Because there's only vaccine in AIDS patients, namely antibody to the virus, so much that we can't find the virus. We treat them with ACT, so that's AIDS by prescription, and we continue to AIDS, but it stays in those risk groups because those are the ones who are likely to have antibody against this virus from many sexual contacts or needle exchanges and so on. So it's really a disaster, unfortunately, that started off with a plan to find viruses that cause cancer. And since that didn't work, we thought, okay, at least we found a virus that causes AIDS. And now AIDS is by no means what it was supposed to be. It's a minority, a very small risk group disease. Unfortunate as it is, these people are actually going to be helped to develop their disease with the drugs we are giving them against the virus that is a passenger virus, a virus that is not ever causing a disease. It's in a million Americans, most of them don't even know about it. That's the hallmark of a passenger. The passenger doesn't cause a disease when it infects you. It's just a passenger. So that's roughly my background. And I thought a lot of my colleagues would be with me because I didn't postulate or even prove or show anything absolutely new. I only showed and said what they had found and I had found. I was part of the team, as you point out correctly. I first mapped out the genetic structure of retroviruses and in the replication I was in, and the proteins, what have you, all of this analyzed. So I said, we have to look somewhere else. But it was not possible to change the flow or the bandwagon, as it was a huge bandwagon, a huge band train, so to speak, of the billions that you mentioned. And particular ones, these terribly expensive drugs like ACT became the standard of care, which are $1,000 a month. You may imagine the profits on also the profit motive that comes in, and people getting cancer easily that would be very hard and competitive to get otherwise. It's a difficult, we are in a big trap, and that's why I'm somewhat pessimistic that it's easily changed, except with your program. Yeah, that's up to you to show us the way how to break through here.
Peter, let's look at some of your earlier research. Take us step by step through what you found and what you decided to do about what you found, and then what was the feedback once you published your results?
Well, in the first sort of quote, if you like, landmark paper was in Cancer Research in 87. In this paper, I pointed out what you already mentioned, that we have a book full of retroviruses. We had dozens and dozens of studies, hundreds of studies, including my own, about retroviruses causing causes of cancer that wouldn't kill cells. They were selected this way. If they would kill cells, there wouldn't be cancer viruses, because they would be, if anything, they would be killing cells. If anything, they would be killing cancers. Some people have searched that too. So I showed that and made that point. They couldn't possibly be causing immune deficiency, because they were even using these T cells, and still now using them, B cells, T cells, blood cells, cell lines, to mass produce virus. Well, why would we mass produce virus? We would mass produce virus to get out the viral proteins, or so-called antigens. And once we had these, we could test people for antibody against these proteins. In other words, this was necessary to test people for AIDS, as they call it, for the AIDS virus. What we're really testing is antibody against the AIDS virus. Why do we do that? Not because we wanted to be particularly fancy. For one basic, very basic reason, this is what I pointed out, because there is no virus in antibody-positive people. Even when they are dying from AIDS, there is no virus there. And there is no precedent anywhere in virology that viruses can do anything, either killing cells or causing flus or hepatitis or pneumonias or diarrheas or any yellow fevers, unless they are there in large numbers. It's like a war. You need a lot of enemies and a lot of soldiers from both sides. The normal cells fighting against the viruses, they have to be both there in large numbers to knock out a large number of cells or damage or change them to cancer, if you want, in certain odd systems, it works, to make a difference, to cause a disease. And we can't find even one. Gallo couldn't find one, had to misappropriate it, so many other cats. But nobody wanted to make that point. How could we ask, how could we look for a virus by looking for antibody against it? That, in all scientists' minds, biologists and tumor biologists and practical doctors' mind, is the ultimate protection against viruses, is a vaccine. Even the AIDS researchers keep calling for a vaccine. But they won't say, they won't follow through, or they won't owe up to the fact that the vaccine is already there. That's all they're testing for. They find antibody with the AIDS test, and say, okay, now you are at risk to get sick. For all other viruses, polio, measles, mumps, herpes, what have you, and even bacteria, syphilis or what, if you have antibodies against it, your doctor will say, that's the best we can do for you. You are as well protected as nature or science can afford to. Only with HIV, it's said to be the other way around. And no doctor thinks about it twice, apparently.
So let me just put this in lay language. Mm-hmm. If you assume that a measles or chickenpox or mumps virus vaccine works, it's because they're giving you a small attenuated amount of the virus, enough to stimulate an antibody response to be protective. But with AIDS, having the antibody then demonstrates that you are going to end up with the disease. This is just opposite everything that basic biochemical science has historically shown. Then if you come down with a flu, if you come down with hepatitis B or C, if you come down with Epstein-Barr virus, you can find a large amount of that virus in your body. With AIDS, you're telling us, if I understand what you're saying, that people who are dying of AIDS, when they check their blood, they can find no HIV virus, though they have the antibodies. So how then is this virus killing people if they can't find it?
That was, in that first article, and in several others afterwards, almost the leitmotif, like the Wagner when you played initially. How could this virus cause immune deficiency by killing T cells when you, I mean us, the AIDS establishment, the companies who wait the AIDS test, Abbott and others, mass-produce the virus, or Montagnier in France, mass-produce the virus in T-cell and B-cell lines, immortalized lines. They're not killed. They're going for 25 years now, these lines, and produce virus and virus and virus. They're immortal and don't die from it. How could that cause AIDS? Nobody ever answered that question. Gallo said, oh, you don't understand. There must be cofactors. But when I asked him what the cofactors were, he never gave a clear answer. There's no consensus cofactor. And I could say the cofactor is, I already mentioned it, and quite a few others have mentioned it too, Sonnabend and Lawitz and many others. The cofactor is not a cofactor, it's a factor by itself. It is taking AZT, it is killing cells, it's inevitably cell killing, and as a result, in the end, inevitably human or host killing. And we use these recreational drugs. If you read the book Inventing the AIDS Virus, or even the band Plays On of the famous book, any book about AIDS behavior, or the latest chemsex brochure came out from England. It's called chemsex. It's pages and pages what gay men in England use as aphrodisiac or sexual drugs, calling chemsex, and getting AIDS from it. That's what it is. That's what was new in the 80s when AIDS appeared. The massive use of recreational and psychoactive drugs, and followed by the antiviral drugs, which are even worse. The DNA chain terminals, at least the recreational drugs, they give you maybe, hopefully, some fun. But the DNA chain terminals, they make you sick from the beginning.
Okay, let's review this. I just want to make sure the audience understands. So on the one hand, everyone, and initially yourself included, believe that a single retrovirus, a weak virus, was able to cause 30 different conditions, including Kaposi's sarcoma, pneumocystis, green pneumonia, and thrush it, and dementia, etc.
But what you believed, at least they accepted it for research. It seemed tempting that such a virus would exist. I think very few real virologists would have said, how is there a virus that can cause 20 or 30 different diseases? I mean, all, even the worst type of viruses, have a certain, what's called a host range. They do something specific. Polio causes poliomyelitis. Hepatitis causes liver disease. Some so-called leukemia viruses cause leukemia. But HIV is supposedly doing all of this. It's killing T cells and B cells. It's causing dementia. It was causing Kaposi sarcoma, weight loss, diarrhea. All of these so-called AIDS-defining diseases by the same virus. I mean, what's the connection between dementia and diarrhea? Nobody ever explained it to me. I checked, asked many. There's none. Oh, it's just AIDS virus. AIDS virus is like Jesus Christ, can do what it wants. Because it's AIDS virus and you get money for it and you're famous for it just to put on your paper this AIDS virus.
All right, so let me just continue. Mm-hmm. However, you began to look at what was more likely a cause of immune deficiency, and that was lifestyle.
Yeah.
And there were three groups of people who had a compromised lifestyle. The fast track, small percentage, generally it's under 2% of gays who were living a very fast track. Now, it was not sex, it was the multiple sexual partners who had sexually transmitted diseases, many of them, who were having unprotected anal intercourse, who were frequently then not realizing that that semen in the anal canal ripping through the tissue can be immunosuppressive, introducing microorganisms into the blood system that can attack the whole system. It was smoking, drinking, amyl nitrate, poppers. I interview people who are having 20 different sexual partners a night, every night, thousands per year. Now that, and then staying up all hours. I looked at one study on sleep deprivation, and chronic sleep deprivation for more than 2 years in and of itself was able to kill people. You also had hepatitis reoccurring. That can kill people. The side effects of poppers, especially done in the amounts that we're talking about, there were at least 9 different scientific papers showing that could end up destroying your immune system. Alcohol, massive use of antibiotics, and take all that together. As I've said before, if you were a vegan, never drank, never smoked, Olympic athlete, and you did AZT and that lifestyle, you'd be lucky to be alive in 2 years. And yet, so that is what you and others began to look at and say, this is the probable cause of AIDS, not a single virus by itself. Then also another group that was very contaminated because there was no screening, real screening of the blood supply. Drug addicts, alcoholics, destitute people would go regularly and give blood because they get 20, 30 bucks for their blood. And that was being brought in, and that blood was like a sewer. So hemophiliacs were getting contaminated blood. Then on top of that, you had the fast-track heterosexuals who were the intravenous drug users, mainly young heterosexual males who were dying in high amounts. I know because I helped oversee the drug rehab development group at the Trafalgar Hospital and the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a scientist. And I saw thousands come through there, and they had used unsterile needles. They had hepatitis, they had herpes 6, they had everything. So they were testing positive. So those are the only three groups that I ever saw that really put themselves at risk. But other people also were looking at these lifestyle factors as important cofactors, and yet the cofactor theory was stopped early on because of two things. One, there was a movement within the gay community to say, if we talk about our lifestyle, even though it's only a tiny fragment of this gays that are engaging in this lifestyle, it will bring homophobic scorn upon the whole movement, and so just keep it as a virus. Two, there were those people who realized, if you want money and you want to have research that is passed by your peer review, if you say it's lifestyle, you're not going to get a nickel. If you say it's a virus, then the door opens.
Am I
reading what you've said correctly?
That is nearly 100% correct. What I would say is it is actually the drugs and the chemicals, the treatments for the virus AZT particularly, and the recreational or psychoactive drugs almost only. You know, promiscuity, maybe not at that drug elevated level, is old, as old as mankind or life is. There have been prostitutes and there has been promiscuity all around and sexual diseases. But you're not dying from this. You may get sick here and then, but that's, you're not wearing out like the AIDS patients, losing weight and dying from it in the end. That is only drugs. That is the chemicals that are new. And guess what? I mean, all the huge literature on AIDS, where do you find a paper? Where do you find in a mainstream journal, in the England Journal of Medicine, in Nature, or in Science, or in Cell, that has ever tested AZT in dogs, in cats, or in fish, and informed the patients, mainly actually the gay and the junkie population, what that does to your dog, your cat, and your mouse, taken at the same doses that they are prescribing it now to these patients? That is a disaster. That it could... I cannot understand why the FDA or some other oversight agencies wouldn't ask for that to be published. I think there are unpublished reports of it, but you don't find these papers if you go to Google or to PubMed and look, what does AZT do to a dog, to a horse, to a cat, or to a mouse? That was the gold standard in the old days for any new drugs. And now we're forgetting it because we are on a compassionate basis. We like these people. We give them the drugs right from the bench, and they should benefit from it. Well, they have not benefited a great deal from it, except commercially also. But the patients, they're still dying from AIDS. Well, they say they're dying slower because they give them less toxic. But why don't they tell us in animals what is really the consequences of only these drugs? Lifestyle drugs or antiviral drugs, and leave alone the sexuality from it. Just the drugs. What do they do to the liver, to your brain, and to your... You can predict it with AZT. AZT is terminating DNA synthesis. What do you want? There's no life with DNA, without DNA on this planet, anywhere. You terminate it, you can predict the consequences.
Peter, tell us more about what you saw when there was a mad rush to fast-track the AZT, get it into the population, and then people who may have been infected but were otherwise healthy, began to get sick and die very quickly. And I know because I was working with various AIDS groups and gay groups and over 1,200 gays, and one of the leading gay physicians, Dr. Stephen Chiesa, and they saw their partners taking AZT at high doses and getting sick and dying, so they didn't want to go that route. And yet there was one common denominator in the larger AIDS community: take your AZT. So when the people got sick, they said, well, the virus is making them sick, so up the dosage. Did you see that also?
Yes. In fact, there is one controlled study on this subject was published. It's called the Concord Study. It was a French-English collaboration in which several thousand British and French male homosexuals subscribed. And the result for a couple of months' treatment, I forgot now how many, six or something, it's published actually in The Lancet. Very, very brief report. You have to read between 10 lines to figure out exactly what happened. But the conclusion was, they concluded, the mortality of those who took AZT as prophylaxis against AIDS was 25% higher with all manipulations that were behind it than in the control population that didn't take it. That was one of the few studies that was a truly controlled study, but Concord study, it's called, 89 or 90 in The Lancet.
What was the blowback from the scientific establishment against you when you were one of a handful of lone voices speaking out against the single virus as causing all these conditions?
Well, there was never a real confrontation. They never wrote a paper, Duisberg, you are wrong, for the following reasons. But they used a sequence of, how would you call it, sanctions nowadays would be the right word. The first thing is, since 1987, when I was still the California Scientist of the Year and had a genius grant, they called it, or an outstanding investigator grant from the NIH at that point for $1 million. From then on, I never ever got a grant from the federal government again for cancer or for AIDS or for retroviruses. And of course, your colleagues at the university follow through on this. Much of the money that the universities make, they keep about 50% of your grant, it's called an overhead, for administration and for university matters. So they don't like you if you are in there a professor without a research grant. And then the next thing that happened, or one of the next things that happened, I couldn't publish, as you mentioned already, papers on this anymore, justifying or arguing with the prejudice or with the practices and sanctions they're dealing with me. They wouldn't be published anymore. They said, well, it has to be peer-reviewed, and the peers thing, this is... needs to be further confirmations, and so on. And then came even a misconduct investigation based on anonymous charges to the president of the university in 2008. And I was exonerated after half a year, but I did not get graduate students anymore. I was not even allowed to present about my research to graduate students anymore, so they wouldn't be misled to come to my lab. So then, in fact, I got one paper. We got one paper published pointing out what we are sort of summarizing now, the last one of its type that I tried to publish, or did publish finally. It is called AIDS Since 1984, No Evidence for a New Viral Epidemic, Not Even in Africa. And that paper was published, or almost published, it was published in electronic form first by a British journal. It was called Medical Hypothesis, a British journal. And Lancet had just apparently bought it or something like that. So, again, anonymous charges that this would endanger public health. Our thinking and our conclusion would endanger public health, global public health, and it was anonymously reviewed and anonymously censored. It was already out as an electronic publication. You could copy it from the public PubMed. and you can read about it in Science. There's a page in Science that reports it. It was censored, and the editor-in-chief was, in fact, fired. And the editorial board was fired and replaced by now some kind of a new journal that's under the control of Lancet or the AIDS establishment in some way. I am not aware. I asked many colleagues, and I still have a lot of colleagues I can at least talk to. Have you ever seen since Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin that a scientist's paper was withdrawn or censored and the editor fired and the journal closed for an opinion without a rebuttal, typically a rebuttal or a jury or an alternative paper refusing it? Nobody knew of a precedent. That was about as far as you could go, and I'm still there, but I have mostly focused on cancer research. That paper was eventually published in an Italian journal. It's an old Italian journal, very good old Italian journal, in 2011, two years later. After 2 years further review, the editor said he's no longer be persuaded by these politics. He wants to see the science, and since nobody had rejected the science with numbers, the paper stands now published in the Italian Journal of Anatomy and Embryology in 2011. But it's virtually impossible to publish or to have students or to get grants in an experimental field like molecular biology, which I am. It's very, very difficult to access, except private foundations. I have some private funds.
Peter, have you ever invited ACT UP or any of the other AIDS Foundation leaders or gay movement to come on the program, or scientists, to debate you? To debate you in a public forum, just so if they believe you're wrong, let them see if they have the science that could convince the public listening whether or not you're wrong or they're wrong.
Well, that's a good idea, Gary. But, I mean, I could say already the chances are not good that you would be coming. If I had, if somebody would set up such a forum, it has to be, I think, a neutral agency who would be the jury there. But they would have any journal open to, wide open, the doors wide open, in Nature, in Science, anywhere, if somebody would write a scientific rebuttal to what I said. Nobody took it. Gallo offered he would. There was even a note printed in one of my last papers in the Proceedings of the National Academy on it, that Dr. Gallo, the at that time leading researcher in HIV-AIDS research, would respond in style and point by point refute me. Nothing ever happened. They could very easily, I mean, it could be the crappiest paper, I would say, exaggerating now, from them to trash me, not a word. Not from Jay Levy, not from Bob Gallo, not from Robin Weiss, not from Harold Varmus, not from Anthony Fauci. Nobody uses his pen, and they have all possibilities in the world to get this paper together. The best thing to do is they send out some anonymous websites, like on the NCI.
Right.
There's no name.
I only have a minute left for this segment. How many articles have you published in the scientific literature in your entire career? Approximately, just a rough guesstimate.
300. Mm-hmm.
All right, 300.
Yeah.
And you got the Genius Award. You were outstanding investigator in the state of California, National Academy of Science member. You were considered the golden boy of American science. So here you are, without question, and no one's ever doubted this, one of America's greatest living scientists, and in your area of specialization in retroviruses, that's where you're the king. They have not found you wrong. They have not risked coming forward and showing, well, we believe Peter's wrong, and here's why. Here's what's wrong with his article. They haven't challenged you. They've done it with innuendo, suppression, and McCarthyistic style of dirty tricks and trolling and excluding you, hoping that you'd be like someone that would wither and die on the vine. Is that correct or incorrect?
That is 100% correct, I have to say, unfortunately, yes.
Okay.
I would have asked for it. I would have said, show me when I'm wrong. I'm trying to help. I'm trying to solve the AIDS crisis, if I could, too. I'm not the mass murderer that they also hint I would be. Yeah. I would I would have liked to help these people. Some of my best friends are from the AIDS community. I'm getting 6-7 emails a week, and they often thank me. My God, I stopped these drugs. It's a new life, and thank you for that.
Peter, I just wanted you to have your opportunity. Now, right behind you, in a moment, we're going to have a Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for his work on discovering the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, which is used in AIDS research, and he is even more defiant than you. Plus, there's over 2,933 scientists, physicians, including multiple Nobel Prize winners, professor emeritus of virology, professors of molecular biochemistry who agree completely with you. And yet, you will never hear them on 60 Minutes. You will never see them in a debate. And my concern is that there's only been one truth, one side of the story, the official side, where those people profit from, either ideologically, politically, or economically, or with their careers, they've prevented this from happening. So I want to say thank you for your courage after 30 years of continuing to hold true. And if anyone in this world has any specific issues you can take with Peter Duisberg on all of his articles, then do so. Because all the magazines he used to publish in, the best scientific journals in the world, will not go through the idea that they're going to deconstruct him and show he's wrong. They haven't done it. So that means that there's another agenda they have. Peter, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary. And say hello to Kerry Mullis if he comes on next.
I will. Next up, Nobel Prize winner, Kerry Mullis. Please stay with us. Now let's go to our next guest, Nobel Prize winner in chemistry for the discovery of the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, which is used in AIDS research, Dr. Kerry Mullis.
California microbiologist Dr. Kerry Mullis was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1993 for his development of one of the most widely used current techniques in molecular biology today, the PCR, or polymerase chain reaction. This revolutionary technique allows scientists to take a sample containing a very minute amount of DNA and replicate that DNA sequence until there are many copies. One of the first applications of PCR was to analyze human tissue for the presence of HIV. PCR is commonly used in medical and biological research labs for the detection of virus culture in infectious persons.
The people that are AIDS researchers now are getting neurotic. If you ask them any questions. There was a time when I first started asking questions, all I wanted was, where are the papers? Just tell me the papers that you read that convinced you that HIV was the cause of AIDS, because I need to reference those papers in some of the, I was working on a test for HIV with PCR, and I needed to write a little report to the NIH to say, here's the progress we've made, and the first line of it was, HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. And I thought that was true. This is before I got involved. And I said, what's the reference for that quote? And I looked for it for about 2 or 3 years and I never could find it. And by the end of 2 years, I'd ask everybody at every meeting that I'd gone to that talked about AIDS, I'd ask, you know, I'd look through every computer database. There is no reference. There is nobody who should get credit for that statement. Now, that's a pretty weird situation in science where getting credit for a discovery is the most important thing in your life as a scientist. It's silly to hear people saying, you don't believe that HIV causes AIDS? You don't believe that? I mean, it's just a word, but it's a very, very important distinction, I think, that you know, that's why, it's become a very emotional kind of thing, because people actually, they get personally committed to what really is a body of evidence that can be analyzed, you know, by lots of people, and at this point, there's so much of it out there, nobody can really analyze it, all of it, but nobody can write a review of it that says HIV causes AIDS because of this. You know, if a postdoc were to write a review of their literature that showed without much doubt that HIV was the cause of AIDS, that guy would be famous. Now there's 100,000 guys out there who had the opportunity 10 years has passed. We've been waiting for this star postdoctoral fella to distinguish himself forever and get a lifelong grant from Tony Fauci, but he hasn't shown up. No one has bothered to write a definitive review. Any journal would take it. That right there proves that HIV does not cause AIDS. Just because Bob Gallo gets up, takes his sunglasses off and says, gentlemen, you discovered the cause of AIDS. That's all we have. New York Times article, CDC report, that's all we have. That's not enough. That's not enough to you know, that is not sufficient to like publish even a meager little scientific paper somewhere. That isn't enough for scientists to believe some inconsequential fact about some star 50 light years away. You know, that's certainly not enough to treat at the cost of billions of dollars a year and at the cost of a lot of lives and anguish and just destroyed, you know, lives have just been totally ruined by this thing on the basis of some flimsy little statement made by a guy who's known to be a crook in lots of other ways. He lied about a whole lot of other stuff. Why we trust him there? If he was a witness in a courtroom, we wouldn't trust his testimony. We've caught him in too many lies. So you don't trust him anymore. Scientists are supposed to have some evidence that leads them tentatively to some conclusion or to some action. They're supposed to be able to show that to other scientists, any interested person, in fact, who's willing to understand what it is that was used as evidence, should be able to say, yeah, I agree with that. That makes sense, using rules of inference that we've used since Aristotle. What they look for is surrogate markers. Now, have you heard that term battered about? Surrogate markers means, well, it doesn't seem to do anything for the disease, but it does every now and then do something for the level of CD4 cells that we measure, or it does something for this or that. Not that anybody really knows whether you want more or less CD4 cells at any particular time in your life. A lot of diseases cause CD4 to go up. A lot of diseases cause it to go down. Nobody's even sure if a CD4 cell is always a CD4 cell. Just it's a marker on the cell at the time that they do this little counting procedure, which is to stick a fluorescent tag on there and say the ones that light up have CD4 on the outside. And we don't really know what those cells do. The immune system is incredibly complicated. The immunologist's brains are not nearly complicated enough to deal with it. We have these little, you know, there are theories all over the place, but no real competent immunologist would tell you that CD4 levels was a surrogate marker for anything until we know more about it. But that's what they're using. That's what the FDA is saying, yeah. You don't have to show that it helps them. These protease inhibitors, the same thing. You don't have to show that it helps the patient. You don't have to show a single life saved. All you have to do is show some little clinical indicator has changed in a way that somebody is hoping is going to make you better. The chances of you getting a human virus today are a hell of a lot higher than they were, say, 10,000 years ago. And it goes up in a funny way. Let's just say that there are an infinite number of retroviruses in the world because they're changing so fast you couldn't really count them. And as more and more people are in your life, you get more and more chances of getting retroviruses. Now, they all might be harmless. The chances are good that they are, because they're just barely alive. But if you hang out with 1,000 people a year in a way that would maybe allow you to get some or most of their retroviruses, and they hang out with 1,000 people a year, and they hang out with 1,000 people a year, you're hanging out with a fourth of the human race. You're getting all the retroviruses from all over the planet. Now, it might be that none of those things by themselves is going to hurt you, but we know that some of them do grow in your immune cells. Right? And they come in at very low multiplicity. You don't make an immune response every time you get a retrovirus inside of you somewhere. But if you have a cell in your immune system that has a retrovirus in it, and you promote that to clonality because it's going to be a part of an immune response, that cell, then the retrovirus will definitely escape. It will flower, in a sense, and it will then have to be dealt with by the immune system because there'll be enough of it showing in the blood that the immune system will go for it. Well, now, if you've got enough harmless but different retroviruses in your immune cells such that every time you mount a new immune response, which means you probably take about 500 different immune cells and make 1,000,000 copies out of each one of them, if you've got enough retroviruses in your immune system such that one of those 500 is going to have a retrovirus in it that you've never made an immune response to before, you're going to have to make an immune response to it this time, because it will, if you make 1,000,000 copies of the cell, it's sure to, the retrovirus is certain to flower, to like make infectious bodies, right? Then you have to make another immune response, right? It's called a chain reaction. Here we have a bunch of people that are definitely sick from some reason. It's likely that their behavior was so radically different than behavior that had gone. It was an experimental kind of behavior in a way. It's not unlikely that they would have some kind of problems, some health problems. People stop sleeping and eating. People start using all kinds of substances instead of food. And they're associating with the world's getting more and more densely populated, and we're spreading more and more diseases around. It's not totally shocking that those people should come down with some diseases that'll kill them. So we don't need to postulate that there was an infection going on, since nobody actually did show that there was. Here comes Gallo and Mountainier and the NIH saying, that's right, it's something else. It's something you didn't have. You're not responsible for it. You're just the beginning of it. We're all going to get it. And they liked that so much, because they said, we can go right ahead and do what we're doing. We just have to do a few little things differently, and then we'll be okay. They cling to that, you know, and they think if you suggest that it's their activity, that the way they live their life, that you're a homophobe or something, you're some kind of an idiot. There's something wrong with you. There's some of them that aren't that stupid, but, you know, there's a lot of them that are religiously associated with the notion. They believe in the notion that it is an infectious thing that will eventually sweep across the planet and kill everybody. PCR came along right about the same time that HIV did, and it was in at CETUS that people started looking with PCR for HIV. That was the only way to see it, except for culture, which was a long, protracted procedure, which a lot of times didn't turn up right. The results there weren't very good either.
Can be contaminated.
Oh, the culture, the whole method, that cell biology is a bunch of magic half the time. And those culture, you know, the people that say they can do quantitative estimations of HIV from cultures are just, they're fooling themselves. The number of cases reported went up epidemically, you know, exponentially, because the number of tests that was done went up exponentially. How many doctors knew about HIV in 1983? Two. How many knew about it in 1985? Say 500. How many knew about it in 1986? 40,000. So that's where the curve came from. How much money did we make off of HIV this year? And they could have plotted that, and it would have looked the same. You know, and they could have said, it's an epidemic, because we're making more and more money off of it every year. If it's just caused by needles, or it's just caused by homosexual activities, you're not going to really get a long, sustained public outcry against it, and nobody's going to want to spend $6 billion a year. They're going to say, well, we really didn't like those people anyhow. Great. I can't think of a better solution to the homosexual problem than a disease that'll kill them all. I mean, there would be congressmen that would talk about that quietly, not on television. So the CDC had to say, we can't say that. We've got to say it's got to be heterosexually transmitted. There's no proof that it's transmitted at all at that point. So why not just say, well, it's heterosexually transmitted too? Because that made it a plague, and the CDC needed one. The CDC hadn't had a good plague since polio. Their funding was probably going to be cut back if they didn't come up with one. The guy that was the head of the CDC, in fact, wrote memos that have been obtained, you know, that where he describes this as hot stuff. You know, those guys have got an agenda, which is not what we would like them to have, being that we pay for them to take care of our health in some way. The scientists are, like you say, they are considered the final arbiters of what's good for the planet or what's bad for the planet. And they hadn't got the slightest idea. Instead of wearing white robes, they wear white lab coats, you know. Instead of, like, bringing you the word of God, they bring you the word of the EPA or whatever. And they don't have to understand what it is that they are making you do, in fact. And people, you know, just, I think they fall naturally into it because there is a need in humanity for something like a religion, something that makes you feel a part of some larger kind of group, something that you think, in spite of your wormy little life, makes you a part of something good, something big. When beliefs get tangled up with facts, matters of fact become matters of religious kind of significance, where if somebody gets mad at you for asking him a question in a scientific meeting, or says, we're never going to have Carrie Mullis at the European Union of whatever kind of scientists, or they put it in Nature, because he came in there and had the audacity to tell people that it might not be that bad to have sex, that AIDS might not be something you get from sex, that I don't see any evidence for it, is all I said. I don't see any evidence for it. What? You can't tell young people that.
Today, there are many scientists and physicians working within the conventional institutions who have similar viewpoints to those of the dissidents. Well, why don't they come out? Why don't they speak their minds? Is it possible that they take a look at what has happened when you do question the HIV equals AIDS equals death hypothesis? They've been suppressed. Dr. Peter Duesberg, noted scientist, was the main person in the line of fire.
Peter is a very scholarly person in addition to being brilliant too. He's very careful. He doesn't say anything that he can't support. And also one of the most brilliant people in, surely the most brilliant virologist.
Peter Duesberg at the University of California, Berkeley campus, is seen as someone who is now dangerous. His funding has been cut off. Graduate students are encouraged not to take his courses, and I think his administrative duties have included being in charge of the department picnic.
My funding, for example, from the National Institute of Health will not be renewed as of this year, and I may be out of business then. Also, my colleagues have essentially excommunicated me. I'm not invited to meetings, or hardly ever to meetings anymore, not ever to one on AIDS. I'm not allowed to publish in the same journals anymore as I used to. Even as a member of the National Academy, I cannot publish in the National Academy my views that drugs may be the cause of AIDS. And I have plenty of evidence to support it, to document my claim, which might be very relevant to the health of millions of Americans and people on this planet. Yet I'm censored, because I'm essentially considered to be an outcast or an odd man or somebody who has controversial views.
He was a really well thought of guy too, because of his ideas, the whole field. I mean, in cancer, he's the guy that led him into the whole oncogene thing, you know? Big research bonanza. Anybody who could order a little kit from some company and hire a couple of technicians could be a cancer researcher. Because of things that Peter opened up. And then Peter said, no, I don't think that's actually the cause of cancer. And that made those guys a little bit angry. And then he comes along and does the same thing for AIDS. He said, you know, I think we're on the wrong track here. You know, it's just like in political scandals. Follow the money trail. Figure out who's getting paid for this. Who's getting the money for those Western blots? There's your person who's going to always come down on the side of, yeah, you got to... confirmatory Western blots, they call it. They don't even do them in England anymore.
No,
but
not since 1982.
And ask a doctor how it works. The doctor who prescribes says, got to have a Western blot to confirm this ELISA positive thing. How does that work, doctor? Sir, what are they now measuring about me that's different from what they measured with the ELISA test? He wouldn't know. He's not got any idea. I'll bet you there's scarcely 50 physicians in this country that know what a Western blot really is. They know when to order it, and they know they get a kickback on it, probably.
AZT is an antiretroviral drug that became the first drug approved for the treatment of AIDS and HIV infection in 1987. It was originally intended to treat cancer, but it failed to show efficacy and had unacceptably high side effect profiles. However, the unavailability at that time for alternatives to treat AIDS affected the risk-benefit ratio greatly.
The antiviral drugs are chemotherapies. They're all based on chemotherapies that have been developed 30 years ago, long before AIDS was known to kill human cells. Chemotherapy is restricted to a few months in the hope the cancer dies before you die.
If you started taking any other chemotherapeutic agent for the rest of your life, it would be that agent probably that killed you. You know, when you give chemotherapy to somebody with cancer, you give them a round of it for maybe 14 days or a few days. Hopefully you're not going to kill the patient. You're going to kill the cancer. The patient's going to survive. But you don't keep giving it to him until he dies, because he certainly will. The way to get rid of AIDS is to stop funding it. Just stop everything that's called AIDS research. Somebody tries to get a grant for AIDS research, say, we don't do it anymore. We don't have AIDS. if you want to study pneumocystis carinii, we'll maybe look at your paper and see if you've got, you know, something to say about that. You want to study any one of those diseases by itself, try to cure it, we'll talk about that.
The thing that I learned, like, back in 1968 when I first published a paper by myself in Nature in a field that I had no expertise in at all, there are no old wise men up there at the top of science, which I would have, I really did until 68, I would have thought, you know, if you try to publish a dumb paper in a journal like Nature, it won't get published. If you try to publish a good paper in there, like I later tried to publish PCR, the invention of PCR, in the same journal, and they didn't take it. So it's up there, there isn't an up there there. There's no place up on the Academy of Science is just a bunch of idiots, just like everybody else. You know, the editors of journals, austere journals even, they're just busy with their little lives and stuff. There are no old wise men up on the top making sure that we don't do something really dumb.
Hey, what's up, man?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Right on. Everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us? Simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Pick it flat and pick it sound. Punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on.